Welcome to the Psych Sessions podcast. This is episode number 17, where Garth and I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Bill McKeachy from the University of Michigan. This is actually, I guess, what we would call a live introduction, because Garth and I are sitting here together to introduce this podcast.
Yeah, this hasn't happened before, I don't think.
No, and this is a pretty special podcast, and so we have a lot of people to thank for this.
Yeah. First of all, this podcast is brought to you by the Society for the Teaching of Psychology, APA Division II, who were generous enough and had this idea that they would like to send Eric and I out to see Dr. McKeachy and to interview him about his legacy in the teaching of psychology.
And we actually want to give a special shout out to Sue France and to Ken Keith, who worked together with the executive committee of SDP to make this happen. And so we're really appreciative of them. There's actually also three other individuals that we have to thank. Jane Hallinan really did a lot of the organizational work and was actually originally planned to join us, but had some issues and she couldn't make it. And so she was instrumental in organizing this.
Even after she wasn't able to be here, I think this interview is happening because of what Jane did.
I think you're absolutely right. Also, we appreciate Linda Dix, who's Bill's sister. And then also Bill has a niece, Lisa Danielson, who actually lives in Ann Arbor, who was actually with us at Bill's room in Ann Arbor in his assisted living facility. And she was instrumental and really helpful and so delightful. And I'm not so sure the interview goes as well as it did without Lisa's help. And so we're so thankful for all those individuals that made this happen.
Right. So we want to set up this interview a little bit and tell you about what it was like to go see Bill McKeachy. You are going to hear his niece Lisa's voice in the room with us. She didn't want to be a distraction, so she kind of went around the corner, but you can hear her. We actually had two systems going for recording in this, and so and that's important because you're going to hear some changes in the audio. One was an ambient mic that was just in the room from the moment we got in to the moment we left, and then we had our typical setup with microphones, and those are kind of a cleaner sound. And we tell you that because at the end of the podcast, we had some really nice moments captured on that ambient mic. And so stick around right to the end. It's pretty special.
Yeah. And, you know, the sound quality wouldn't be what we would always hope it would be, only because when we're sitting with Bill McKeachy in his room, we didn't have a situation where we could put a mic right in front of him. And so, again, the sound quality may not be up to what we typically have in a podcast with an interview, sitting at a table. Also, I want to give kudos to my podcast buddy Garth here. He's done an amazing job with the editing. And so sometimes I ask questions out of order. Sometimes things aren't so sequential. And so we have edited this. We do from time to time. And so this is not a perfectly accurate historical record of exactly what we said from start to finish. That was never the intention. And so we just want you to know that, kind of a truth in advertising.
We thought it was important to just set up the interview, what it was like. And so Eric and I flew into Detroit and drove out to Ann Arbor. And we went to where Bill McKeachy is living, an assisted living facility in Ann Arbor, a really nice,
very nice
place. And so when we entered the room, and we have some of that, I think that's how the podcast starts, is us entering the room. It's like a little apartment that he lives in, and he was sitting in his chair, and he was right there as soon as we walked in the room with Lisa.
Any of you who know Bill, you know, and I had pleasure getting to know him, to get to write a little bit about his life in a couple of biographies. He's got the most recent issue of American Psychologist on his book stand. He's still reading in psychology. You know, it's clearly that sharp, bright mind is still working in terms of psychological ideas. And so if you listen to the podcast, you're going to get it, how much we enjoyed it and how much we were there to honor him and just to kind of capture the stories of, you know, who he knew in his career. I mean, he has a friendship with Fred Skinner. You know, the rest of us call him B.F. Skinner, but that's Fred to Bill McKeachy.
Yeah, and it was a really enjoyable time. I think, now, you had met him in the past, and he remembered you. And for me, I'd never met Bill McKeachy before. And so what I noticed during the interview is that the rapport kind of grew for the hour that we were there. Over time, the stories become a little bit longer. I mean, the man is 96 years old.
Right. For everybody, I think sitting in front of a microphone is a little bit of an odd experience, no matter what your age is. And I think he became more comfortable with that. As familiar as he might have been with me and meeting you for the first time, I think it just takes a while to warm up and to have stories and talk about it. And obviously, as you listen to the interview, it's pretty clear he becomes more comfortable and a little bit more talkative. And we're asking him about a career that lasted over 60 years. And so it would be hard for me to remember things back from the beginning of my career if I had a 60-year career.
Right.
So,
interesting that things that might be very significant to us, those might not be the same things that he would have found the most significant things about life and career looking back at this age.
Absolutely. We wanted to be sensitive to things that have gone on in his life. We interviewed him in February of 2018, and sadly, just in 2017, his wife of 74 years, Jenny, passed away. And we learned while we were there just the year prior to that, one of his daughters passed away. And so, you know, he's 96 years old, and, you know, two treasured people in his life have passed away. And so we were just thrilled that he was willing to see us and sit down for a discussion.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, but what was your favorite moment or your takeaway?
I think just to see him again. You know, I think I saw him probably last in, I want to say, 2011, 2012 at an STP event. I believe during Reagan-Gurung's presidential year, Reagan gave the STP presidential citation to Bill McKeachy, and Bill and Ginny were there. And that's probably the last time I saw him. And like Jane, I've been an unofficial biographer of his. And so I've gotten to know him over the years. And so just to see him again and to say the things that I say in this podcast and to thank him, that was a touching moment for me because I know the influence he's had on my career, and I can imagine the influence he's had on thousands of psychology teachers and thousands of teachers who have read Teaching Tips.
Right. So. And so that was my favorite moment when we were able to reflect on who does this whole teaching of psychology thing come back to? And we were able to do that with him in the room. I don't know the man outside of that hour. But I've heard these stories about humility, kindness,
right,
and that just comes through. There are so many softballs we were throwing up to him just to say, yeah, I'm pretty good. I did a lot.
I don't know if he's the founder of the teaching of psychology as a discipline. I don't know if I want to call him the father of the teaching of psychology. He's not the godfather. I don't know the right term for him. I don't know the right moniker. But certainly people talked about the teaching of psychology before Bill McKeachy. But I think as a scholarly discipline and the way we think of things now, he is patient zero. He's where it starts, and he's the inspiration for many of the people who come after him who have made an influence in our field.
Yeah, that's well said.
I just want to say once again, we're so thankful to STP and all the people who made it possible. And we hope that you enjoy this podcast as much as we enjoyed recording it.
Hi, Bill. It's good to see you again. Eric Landrum. It's so good to see you. I have something for you from Jane Hallinan.
Oh, that's nice.
It's a hug. I'll give it to you later.
Very good.
She's so sorry she's not here.
Hi, Dr. McKeachy. My name is Garth.
Garth.
From Seattle.
Seattle.
Yes, yeah.
What you doing clear over here?
Well, I think we came to see you.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Today we're in Ann Arbor, Michigan with Dr. Bill McKeachy from the University of Michigan. And it's just an absolute honor to be here. So many people made this trip possible. And we'll talk about those folks a little bit later on. But Bill, thank you for taking the time this morning to talk with us.
Well, I'm honored.
Well, actually, we're the ones that are honored, but thank you. Could you talk a little bit about how you actually got to become a college teacher?
When I went to college, I went to Michigan Normal College. They only had two courses in psych, ed psych and general psych. And I majored in math. So I graduated with a math major, went into the Navy for 3 years, and wrote to my wife that when I got out, I'd like to go into psychology. And so I did.
And so you grew up in Michigan, is that correct?
Yes.
But then you, when you got out of the Navy, you went to grad school at Michigan, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then your first, when you went on the job market, what was that like?
Well, my best friend and I went to the department chair to talk about getting jobs when we were finishing our PhDs. And he said, oh, you can get a job anywhere. Everybody's looking for faculty with this GI Bill. I didn't know where I was going to get a job, but anyway, department chair had me in. He said, you know, I know. He asked me where I wanted to teach. I said, I'd like to go to either to, what are those schools? A couple of girls' schools. I can't remember the name of them now. But anyway, a little while later, the department chair called me in. He said, you know, instead of going off to teach at a women's college, why don't you stay here and train our graduate students to teach? Well, that was a novel idea. People didn't train people to teach in college at that time. And I said, okay, that sounds fine. Well, I came down for a program they called the 90-Day Wonder Program. In 90 days, they trained us to be the equivalent of Annapolis graduates. And so went through the physical and everything. And as I was signing up, I said, it said I agreed not to get married while I'm in training. And I said, well, can I get married afterwards? He said, sure, if you're in this country, we won't promise you where you'll be. So I said, I'm not going to do it then. So I called Jenny's mother, and I said, can Jenny and I get married next Friday because I've got to enlist in the Navy on Saturday? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, I guess you can have the wedding in our living room. So I hadn't had dates in college because I played piano and bar
right,
weekends.
Right, I remember reading about that.
And I decided I wanted to get a date with one of two girls for the last big dance of the year. And Jenny was sitting on a hitching block waiting to be taken out to Lincoln School to do our practice teaching. And I asked her if she'd go to the Spring Breeze with me. And she said yes. And we had a few coke dates. It looked like I was going to get drafted, so I asked Jenny if she'd marry me. The rest is history. We were married 74 years.
Wow.
I've been reading a lot of your works this past week, getting ready to see you today.
Oh.
And your first journal article, how many people in your life tease you? Does anybody tease you in your life?
I don't know.
Your daughter or your niece? I'm not going to tease you, Bill, but...
That's all right. Go ahead and do it.
No, but your first journal article was in the American Psychologist.
Is that right?
Yes, in 1951. It was an article about teacher training, and I read it. I actually have it with me. I'll leave the paper copy with you. And by the way, we're sitting in Bill's room right now. It's February, and on his nightstand, I'm actually looking at the latest issue of American Psychologist. So he's still reading.
Still reading.
At 96, he's still reading. But yeah. So you're a new assistant professor. You're 30 years old. You're in your job at Michigan. And your first journal article is in the flagship journal of the largest psychological organization in the world. How does that happen?
I don't know. Just luck, I guess.
No. Just luck, I guess.
You can't say it yet. Eric doesn't believe in luck. He thinks that you were probably well prepared.
And worked very hard.
Oh.
I'm going to give that one to you.
Okay.
Well, I'll come back to that later. your entire career was at Michigan. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But did you ever do like a visiting semester anywhere, or you didn't go to Oxford for a semester or go anywhere or do any of that?
I kept getting invitations, but I kept thinking I would leave, you know, when the right one came along. But somehow I never got an offer that I liked better than staying here.
Did anyone try to lure you away permanently to come to their institution?
Oh, yeah. I had quite a few job offers.
Okay.
It would have been hard to probably find a good softball team outside of Ann Arbor, I imagine, right?
Oh, I don't know. I could have organized one almost anywhere.
There's a quote that you said, I don't remember where it's published, that said, I would not trade my 31 no-hitters for 31 publications anywhere.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you loved your sports. You loved that softball
team.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I think you had one perfect game.
The ball's over there.
Oh, you're right. I see. You've got a couple softballs, a trophy, intramural champion. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I see those here on your windowsill.
Yep.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, and I think you had one perfect game, if I remember. You pitched one perfect game.
Yeah.
For the record.
Well, I pitched 3 no-hitters in 1975.
Alone? Really? Look at that.
Yeah.
3 no-hitters in 75.
Do you think you worked harder or did you play harder in your career? Because you worked pretty hard.
I did both.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I first heard about you when I'm a little bit younger than you are. But I first heard about you through your book, through Teaching Tips, because somebody had gifted it to me a number of years ago. I've actually had it gifted to me a number of times.
Very good.
Yeah, and it's still being published. And when did you get the idea to write Teaching Tips?
Well, I didn't intend. Well, it wasn't going to be a book. I used to have these notes for my teaching assistants, and once they got away, they'd write back and say, could you send us a copy of those teaching tips? And so I'd send them one. Marilla Svinicki, I liked the way she taught and in her writing talked about a theory as well as I asked her to take it over. Now in its 14th edition.
So many graduate students are thrown into the classrooms. First-year faculty with no training, as we all know, are thrown into the classroom. And that made their students' experiences better. And not just in psychology, but all across teaching. Uh-huh. It's not teaching tips for psychology teachers. It's teaching tips for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so it's an amazing influence that your career has had on hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of students. Well, and this is the humility that you have, and so this is where I get to be in a room with you and praise you for all that you've done.
Oh, so thank you.
You're welcome. While we're on the topic of books, if you don't mind, you wrote an introductory psychology textbook.
Yeah.
Do you remember much about that experience? Was it pleasant? Was it joyful? Was it painful?
I don't remember at all.
Yeah. You actually, it went into a third edition, so it must have had very good success to make it to a third edition.
Yeah, it did all right, I think.
Because right now, that as you can imagine, that market is very saturated. Millions of students every year in the United States take that class, and I'm sure it was a competitive market when your book came out in the 1960s. I'm sure it was.
You're a former president of the American Psychological Association.
Yeah.
When did you have aspirations to do that early on, or do you remember how?
No,
that...
I didn't have any aspiration like that. I just they just elected me.
Do you remember anything from your presidential year? Were there any issues that you can remember that you had to deal with? Was there any?
Well, it was fine. Yeah, I didn't have any serious problems.
Did you have to be in Washington D.C. a lot away from home when you were president?
Well, yeah, but then I was. Even before that, I was doing a lot of traveling because I was invited to speak all sorts of places. So I did a lot of, usually about 20 trips a year.
Wow.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, 7 honorary degrees. At least 7. The last time I saw something.
Uh-uh.
So you, yeah, a lot of traveling. Yeah.
Did you travel? You traveled internationally as well as nationally.
Oh yeah,
domestically. Yeah.
In fact, I think you went and did some faculty development in Malaysia. Was that? I think you traveled to Malaysia once and invited Jane Hallinan to go with you. And I think that's where the two of you really got to know each other quite well.
Uh-huh.
If I'm recalling the stories that she's told me.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Was teaching across culture, teaching teachers, I'm guessing you're talking to teachers probably.
Yeah.
Was that different than talking to teachers here in the United States?
Oh, no, it's some, but not much. Not terribly different. Mm-hmm.
So, Bill, if I could talk to you a little bit about the people that you knew over the course of your career, some at Michigan, some throughout psychology. So I'm going to start the people at Michigan. And I think we've talked about this before in the past. I think your first year was close to the last year or couple of years of Rensis Likert.
Oh, yeah.
At Michigan. So you knew him. Is that correct?
That's right.
Just that someone knew him, the Likert scale, which everyone pronounces his name wrong, pretty much. I hope I got it right in saying Likert.
That's right. Yeah.
But that connection is pretty interesting. I also actually read something. You also knew Norman R.F. Meyer.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So here's I'm going to do a personal digression. So Norman R.F. Meyer did a lot of work over his career. You wrote about him, actually. He did some insight tests. He did like insight tests, cognitive stuff. And one of his tests was called a two-string test. You get a person in a room, put two strings too far apart for them to reach, and the task was to tie them together. I actually replicated Norman R.F. Meyer's two-string task in my dissertation. 160 subjects, one person at a time.
Wow.
And so, but in my reading this week, I read that he was at the University of Michigan and that you had known him very well.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm going to talk to Bill McKeachy about Norman R.F. Meyer. There are some classic people in psychology that I think I'm pretty sure you knew. You were friends with Fred Skinner.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, your relationship, your friendship with B.F. Skinner?
Well, we corresponded some, and then he wrote and said, you know, there's no sense in our keeping in touch with each other. We're never going to agree.
So have you kept those letters? Are they at the archive in Akron?
They probably are.
I hope so.
I don't remember.
Those would be classic. I hope those are in the archive somewhere.
I think they probably are.
What kinds of things did you disagree about?
Well, he was a behaviorist, you know, the classic behaviorist. And cognitive psychology was just coming in then. So I was essentially arguing for putting more emphasis upon thinking about the material and not just memorizing it.
Oh, I remember it. Didn't you tell him you didn't like his terms for operant conditioning?
Oh, yeah.
I think there's somewhere written, and I think you might have told him, oh, these terms are dumb. Why would you use such dumb terms?
Many of my students agree with you.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah. I have the video. Someone told me that you were there. He gave his last address in 1989 at APA.
Oh.
And someone told me you were there. I wasn't, but I have the video of it. And it was actually 11 days before he passed away. Mm. And he calls cognitive psychology a shambles and the audience gasps and all this. And I mean, he was that radical behaviorist. And so, he was not very flexible in his views about behavior.
How did you stay friends with B.F. Skinner with such different opinions about psychology?
Gee, I don't know. We just got along very well together, even though we didn't agree on things. But I liked him, and he seemed to like me.
And then also, you—I don't know how well you knew him, but you knew Abe Maslow.
Oh yeah.
But he wasn't at Michigan. I don't think.
No.
Yeah. So did just by letters or by correspondence, or you saw him at conferences, or
I don't remember how. Okay. But we were friends.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Leon Festinger also.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I think your stature in the field, APA president, Michigan, really gave you a window to anyone in psychology.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Somebody said in a chapter about you, they said that they had never heard you say a bad thing about another person.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm sure it's happened maybe in private somewhere.
Well,
maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
I think it was Charles Brewer. I think it was Charles Brewer who said, he said some really lovely things. He said, first off, and I'm not going to get the quote exactly right. He said, Bill McKeachy and I have eaten enough stale Danish at council meetings to sink a battleship. And then he said, he's the only biped on the face of the planet who's never said an ill word about anyone.
Oh, wow.
I mean, just high praise about you, as does everyone I know.
Very nice.
I see that you have the University of Michigan. I'm looking at the M right now here on your window. As I have read about your department, it seems like that work was more than just work to you. You did I think you set up a card game, a regular card game, and
that's right, murder.
Talk about murder. Was that did you make that game up?
Well, it was made up by our grad students who were bridge players. But sometimes they'd have three, sometimes five or six. So they invented a game you can play with any number from 3 to 7. And like in bridge, you bid to make trump. And it's a game that's going on almost every noon for years now. And it was called murder because once Warren Norman, who succeeded me as department chair, screamed so loud when somebody trumped his ace that a graduate student came running down the hall, a couple of graduate students came running down the hall thinking somebody had been murdered.
Oh, that's great.
Lisa, your niece, is with us here today, and she just she said that you play still once or twice a week. You still play the game.
Yep.
Are you any good at it?
Well, I win my share.
Does any money change hands? Is there any?
No,
there's no betting, no chips, nothing.
No.
I've got the rules in my hand.
Any bragging rights? Is anybody keeping score over time?
I don't think so.
No.
So at the University of Michigan, the faculty, the psychology faculty, were they pretty close, or you were pretty close with your grad students?
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, we got along very well together.
And your graduate students, you know, universally. When we did interviews for the book chapter, for example, Scott Vanderstop would talk about, he was your very last dissertation student. And I remember talking to him about you and Ginny would have your grad students over, you would have them over for dinner, you would go out for coffee. I think the model that you had for mentoring your graduate students is amazing. That just they became part of your family. Had them over to your house. I mean, that's amazing. That's lovely.
Good.
They were very. I know they are very appreciative of that.
What role do you think mentoring plays in the teaching of psychology or in teaching in general?
Well, I think it's very important. Yeah, you know, you learn more from that than just reading in a book or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that? I think I would say that that's some of the value of turning up at conferences.
Meeting, oh, yeah.
You know, you have your national... Did you have national colleagues that you had your local colleagues? Did you also feel like you had a national set of colleagues that sharpened you as a teacher?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
When did you move from faculty or from teaching to administration? Because you were division chair for... quite a lot of time at University of Michigan.
Department chair. Yeah, for 10 years.
For 10 years. Was that a difficult decision to go move out of the classroom?
I don't think it was. I don't really remember.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great quote. I'm not going to get it exactly right. It's in something I think when Jane interviewed you for a book chapter, and it goes something like, people looked at me when you went from being in the department as a faculty member to chair, you said something like, it was like going from being part of a nunnery to the head of a house of prostitution. Something like that. I'm not getting that quote exactly right.
You're terrible.
But no, it's lovely and funny, and I'm sure very true. And I'm pretty sure that's in something that Jane wrote about you.
How has teaching changed over the years? Do you think the profession of teaching has changed a lot?
Well, quite a little. I mean, when I started, everything was behaviorist. And then behaviorism was superseded by cognitive psychology. That was, in many ways, more fun, I think.
We were discussing how some of your writing, we feel like, preceded a lot of what we learned in cognitive research.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you, Garth. It really is true. So you wrote something, I'm going to say 1963, 64, and it's a summary chapter about a bunch of different things of what we know. And you wrote something about, you know, which is better for student learning, lecture versus discussion.
Uh-huh.
And you talked about Phillips 66, this discussion technique. And you talked about, well, in general, discussion works better for student learning, but with the exception of these specific circumstances, and you cited all this literature. And you know what? That pretty much holds true today in 2018.
Wow.
Where we have a little bit different terms. We talk about evidence-based instructional practices. We talk about active learning. But it's pretty much the exact same thing. It's better than lecturing, but with the exception of certain practices. And so the things that you were talking about 60 years ago, 70 years ago, the research that you were doing, the research that you were citing, still holds true today. You were talking about things like instructor-centered versus student-centered. We're still talking about those things today.
Wow.
Yeah. You were at way ahead of your time.
Oh,
and still relevant today.
Where did you, these ideas about how people learn, the best ways for learning in a classroom, these were, I guess, based on your experiences in the classroom. And now we've verified a lot of them to be true.
Yeah.
How did you learn these things? How did you come up with these ideas? You observed that certain things worked better than other things?
Yeah. I thought they did anyway.
Now we know they do, some of them.
Yeah. Did you ever have any bad teaching experiences? I mean, did you ever have any courses or sections that just didn't go well?
I don't remember any.
Of course it
but
doesn't.
I told people one of the nice things about the job is that if you do well, your students come back and tell you. If you don't do well, they don't come back.
That's true.
What's that?
Oh, just a note. We wanted to ask you about, at University of Michigan, there's a lecture hall named after you.
What?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Not too long ago, but I don't remember exactly when. Yeah, that's a great honor. Yeah, they had me there for a dedication.
Did you give a talk?
I think I did. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Because Bill McKeachie should give a talk in the McKeachie Lecture Hall.
That's true.
And I'm sure you broke them up into groups and did discussion and, you know, had them report out.
Right.
I mean, of course.
What an honor. How many years did you work at University of Michigan?
Well, probably 65.
When you became department chair, it was already a big department. It was, I think, 70 faculty members.
Yeah.
But you grew it in 10 years to 200.
Was it that big?
Yeah.
My God.
In 10 years,
Wow.
From 70 to, I can't imagine a faculty of 200 people in your faculty.
That's a lot.
That is in a 10-year span. I can't imagine all the hiring and all the interviewing and reviewing all those dossiers and all of that.
Yeah.
You'd have been on going to dinner interviewing someone all the time. I mean,
well,
it would have
almost
been constant.
A lot of our time. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what a legacy. We could pick any one of those pathways. You know, the international travel, the mentoring, the hiring, the books, you know, APA service, any one of those pathways is an amazing career for one person. That you do six or seven of those in one career is unheard of.
I was just lucky.
Yeah.
Do you?
Okay, that's two. I'm going to give him one more, and then I'm going to gently debate the man.
Do you?
I promise to be gentle.
What recommendations do you have for young teachers?
Don't figure you've got to do it all yourself. And get to know each one of your students personally. I used to have every student turn in a picture and something about their interests. And then even in a class of 500, I've had them put these on cards and turn them in. I'd pick up this card and I'd say, Joe, what about so and so and so and so? And so they had to be ready to respond.
And what did that do for your relationship with students to have that information?
I think it helped. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they didn't object too much.
I just can't imagine that. I mean, I teach in classes. The largest classes I teach are like 280.
Well, I have a question about lots of... you said that you would recommend that people don't try to do it all themselves. How did you... That makes me think about work-life balance. In your career, how did you manage family and outside commitments versus work? Because you must have worked a lot.
Well, I kept busy, all right, yeah. Uh-huh. But nothing unusual.
Nothing unusual.
Very supportive wife.
Yeah,
His faith.
Yeah. Yeah, can you talk about your faith a little bit? Because I know that you almost became a minister, or you did become a minister at some point.
I was a Methodist minister for a little while. I never became a Methodist. I was brought up as a Presbyterian. And, I would have been a conscientious objector most any other war. But World War II seemed there definitely was a good side and a bad side. And I talked to one of my friends about it who was studying to be a minister at Garrett Seminary in Chicago. And he said, well, you've thought about becoming a minister. I've got 9 little churches in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to serve every weekend. I can't serve 9 churches adequately. Take 2 of my churches. And if you want to, you can probably get deferred. If you don't want to, you can always enlist. So I did. Became pastor of the Trout Lake and Hulbert Methodist churches in the Upper Peninsula. Actually, I kind of enjoyed being a minister.
How old were you at that time? That was...
Oh, probably 22 or 3.
Okay.
And if this is a stretch, then forgive me, but don't you think in some ways those ministerial duties of preaching and helping people kind of continued in your classroom?
Could be.
In terms of delivering a message of help and encouragement and helping people understand themselves. I mean, you were delivering the science of psychology, but some of those same skills that you exhibited from a pulpit maybe perhaps would have been from a lectern.
That could have been.
I see some continuity.
Yeah, sometimes talk about transferable skills, right?
Yes.
And that's,
That seems to, for me, to mesh very well, the caring about your congregation or caring about your classroom.
Seems to transfer.
Very good.
Makes sense to me.
I think so.
Yeah. Now you enjoyed music. You sang in...
Yeah, I sang in the church choir, and I kept on singing in the choir until I was 85. And then we had to give it up because my wife couldn't climb the stairs to the choir loft.
So that's something you did together, was you sang together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my wife was an alto, and I was a bass.
I hear that your piano is here.
That's
in
right.
This facility. And so how often do you sing here? Do you still get down there and sing? Does someone play for you? And
No. I play myself.
Oh, okay. So he plays and he sings.
Well, he's been playing for a long time, since you were a boy, right?
5 years old.
And are you writing the music, too? Are you writing the compositions yourself?
No, I'm not.
Bill, is there something in your life that you've always wanted to do and never were able to do?
I can't think of anything.
Of course.
Do you play classical music or hymns, or what do you play out there?
Both. I mean, I can play most anything by ear, so... anything that's kind of familiar, I can play.
Back in your club days, and this is a long time ago, I remember reading about the bartender would set up Cokes for you. What were you playing back then? What do you remember at all the songs that you were playing on piano back then?
Guys, no, I don't.
Okay, that's fine. That's good.
It was square dancing, though.
Too, yeah. I played fiddle for the square dancing. And piano for the round dancing at the Palau Tavern in Michigan up in White Lake.
How far are we right now from where you grew up?
Oh, 50 miles.
While we're here, what other instruments do you play? You played fiddle, you played piano, you sing.
Yeah.
What other hidden talents should we know about?
I don't know.
You play
any
other instruments? Trombone?
No.
Oboe?
No.
Flute?
I don't think I had anything else.
Play ukulele?
No.
No.
I'll throw one more out there. Accordion?
Okay.
It seemed like it might be in the wheelhouse, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So music was a part of your life growing up. Your family emphasized.
My mother always wanted to play the piano. She started me when I was 5. And every week she'd say, if you're not going to practice more than 15 minutes a day, I'm not going to drive 11 miles to Milford to have you take your piano lesson. I thought that'd be fine.
I kind of think she had a point. You know, 11 miles, yeah.
Anyway, by the time I got to be 12 or 13, I began enjoying it. So I've been playing piano ever since.
And if I remember correctly, your father was a teacher, is that right?
That's right. I went to him for my first 8 years, one-room country school.
Wow, that must have been, was that a little bit of pressure, or was that just a sheer pleasure?
I thought he was harder on me than on other students.
Really?
Because he didn't want to appear to be showing favoritism.
How did his teaching... Do you think it affected the way that you ended up teaching in the classroom?
Probably did, but I don't know.
Uh-huh. And I don't remember reading about this. Brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers. One's a math professor at Flint, and... my other brother is an editor in Ohio.
Okay.
And my sister died relatively young.
Okay.
But I keep in touch with her former husband.
Oh, okay. And out of the four of you, what's your birth order?
First birth. I'm the oldest.
Okay.
All right. And high achiever, I guess.
I don't know.
So what else do you do for music around here? You play the piano, but it sounds like you also go to jazz club.
Oh, yeah.
What is jazz club?
Tuesday nights, the Easy Street Jazz Band plays at Zelgaz Grotto. And they play the kind of, well, I guess the kind of old music that I used to play. And so I enjoy them.
They don't ask you to come up on stage and join them?
Well, once in a while they have me come up and sing, yeah.
Oh, great.
And there's a woman who likes to sing. And if she was going to sing, they'll have me come up and sing harmony with her.
You can still hit those low notes?
Yep. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that the bass part is lost. I don't think we hear it very much anymore in music, in modern music. Yeah, not so much.
It's too bad.
Not that classic four-part bass.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah. Very, very few people can hit those low notes, I think.
I can only go down to two octaves below middle C.
I don't know what that means. I think the two of you are the music people in the room. It sounds impressive, and I'm just going to nod like I think it's
impressive. Oh, it's impressive.
It is impressive. I'm sure it is.
Very good. What else do we want to talk about? We don't want to take too much of your time.
Right. We're thrilled that you made time for us today.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. That's very nice.
It has been wonderful.
I enjoyed it.
And we know so many teachers of psychology who were thrilled to even hear about that we were going to be here and get a chance to chat with you and record this so that, you know, we could share it with them. And, you know, lots has been written about you, but just to hear you talk about your past and, you know, I never met Fred Skinner. He never argued with me, you know, through letters. And so it's fun to hear that story and to hear you talk about your past and growing up and things like that. I'm not the representative of teachers of psychology, but I'm going to pretend to be for a moment. And just to thank you, Bill, for just everything that you've contributed in your career, whether it's at Michigan, teaching tips, American Psychological Association president, president of Division II, you were president of AERA, the list goes on. I mean, teaching
more than my share.
Well, and we're happy about that. I mean, maybe you say more than your share. That's maybe true, but we're the beneficiaries of it. We're all better teachers because of you, and that means our students are better learners because of you. And I thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I hope that's true.
I believe it to be true.
And you know, the way that Division II has worked since I've been in Division II for about 10 years is a very casual mentoring model. So what I understand about, for example, your friendship and relationship with Jane Hallinan is that she's learned a lot from you as a mentor.
Well, I've learned from her too.
And that's the way it works, right? But then Jane has had this huge effect on the teaching of psychology and has really changed has really helped so many people in a younger generation, and it just goes on and on. And, you know, in some ways we trace it back to just a few folks, and you're one of those people that we trace it back to.
That's great.
Yeah. So
The teaching family tree kind of starts with you. The teaching of psychology family tree starts with you, and the branches all really come from you.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, if you think about it, who was the teaching of psychology influence before you? Who was really passionate about the teaching of psychology before you? I honestly can't think of anybody.
Right.
That's true.
Can you? I mean, and no. you would have known them.
Yep. No, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of researchers and scientists.
A ton of researchers, but...
Yeah.
But who was writing about the teaching of psychology? Mm-hmm. There might have been an occasional article about it in The American Psychologist, but really no one who made their career about the teaching of psychology or improving student learning the way that you made your career about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been lovely. Thank you.
I enjoyed it.
So here, I want to give you, this is your first publication in The American Psychologist.
Oh my gosh.
And this is the chapter that I wrote about your uncle.
Oh, I'd love to read that.
Who's your uncle?
Oh, see, more than just luck. Yeah, it was perfect.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I wrote that in 2002. And
I'm going to read this to you.
And you will... well, you heard the love and adoration, I hope.
Oh, yeah.
You'll read it.
That's very nice.
And there, so.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
That's... your first publication is, wow. is an American Psychologist.
That's amazing.
And you're still reading journals.
Sure.
Are you writing anything these days?
No.
Okay.
Bill, anytime you want to start writing anything, or just for you, we can do that.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, I started an autobiography.
I know
once.
You did.
You did?
Yeah. But I didn't get very far.
Okay, get your book.
Wow. Oh, yeah, my book.
Yeah,
that's right.
You really should.
Yeah, I will.
I don't mean to be pushy about it. Thank you for helping him remember.
Sure.
Because I already have one. I have an autographed copy.
Yep, this is what made the Holly High Fight song. I mean, he's just been...
Oh, yeah. That's one of my accomplishments. When I was in high school, my best friend and I said, you know, it's stupid that we're singing the Cornell University fight song. We ought to have our own fight song. So he and I composed the Holly High School fight song. When I was in college, they had a contest to write a new alma mater for Eastern Michigan University, and we won. For Holly High, doo-doo and I, who raise the colors to the sky, the red and gray will lead the way, da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-dum, so on.